And I thought that was great. It was great to hear a young fellow say that, because that is much more the thing, often the thing that comes up in women's conversations about how the fundamental importance of relationship and centering on relationship and processes as being every bit as important as the structure and the outcome of something. So I just would bring that to our attention. I think this whole issue of really caring about one another, and you know, with recent events in the world, Katrina, Rita, mudslides, earthquakes, I stepped back from it all a couple of days ago and I said to myself, somehow there's a signal here that what's most important for all of us to be about in this world is taking care of one another. Because when events like that happen, that becomes, in all of our minds, such a priority, such a first, so important. We all sort of want to be a part of something that makes a difference. What does that say to us? I think that's a very important kind of realization. You probably, I'm not sure if they mentioned it, but Ohio had its first constitution in 1802. And what's important to note about it is that it included the following statement, and they were speaking of the people of the state of Ohio. Speaking of the people, they said, every free Republican government being founded on their sole authority. The reason that's so important is it's not only in Ohio that you see something like that. Almost every state constitution has a statement very like that, that all power rests in the people of the state. That's not where it rests today, but we as citizens need to go back and uncover some of that early constitutional history and law within our own states and bring it forth and use it and teach with it and engage people and encourage them around it, because I think it's important. And every state that is beginning to move forward on new grounds, on really democratic initiatives, we'll talk about them briefly, is going back to that early constitutional legitimacy for their work. And so there it is in Ohio. So, of course, they started out, and I know we've talked before, most of us have been together at my house one time, and I'm sure you as Greens know a good bit about the whole business of a corporate charter and how it started out being a pretty rigorous thing. Corporations had to jump through pretty strict hoops. They were only in existence for a certain number of years, and then they had to reapply for another charter, and they couldn't own stock in another corporation, and their books were always open to the public, and they were fully liable for harms done to the public good, and a few other important things. And if they didn't live by this charter, if they violated this charter, they were capable of having that charter revoked. And they were, as a corporation, the language has been used, put to death. And Ohio did very much the same thing. They chartered, there's, in this little book, there's a whole list of specific charters that they gave to a bunch of corporations, banks, turnpike corporations, a mill, a few other things. And they are very clear as to what they can do, what they can't do, why they were brought into existence at all. That's all they could do. They couldn't go off and make widgets if they were brought into existence to build a turnpike. They simply could not do it, or they were brought before either the legislature or the court. Well, it all sounded great, of course. And by the way, the people in Ohio put the authority over corporations into the legislature. They kept it as close to themselves as possible. They put the authority over corporations with their elected representatives that they can diselect if they want to. But it didn't work very well, because pretty soon the legislature was so dreadfully corrupted by the corporate powers that were in a position to make money, give money, bribe, exert influence, and so forth and so on, give favors. And in 1833, it's kind of a sad commentary, actually. And it's, let's not be naive. What does that mean we're really up against when we go to try to do it differently, to redefine this stuff? Where does authority lie, and how do we keep authority honest? Because here we had this legislature elected by the people. Oh, great. And they just gave away the store. And to prove it, in 1833, the legislature passed 33 general laws and 250 special pieces of legislation giving special privileges to corporations. 30 to 250. And it just kept getting worse every year, such that by 1851, they gave away 817 pieces of special legislation to the corporations. In 1 year, 800 and some. So the people were irate. And I think, again, that's important to note. The citizenry of the state was on top of this. They sort of said, that's enough. We're writing a new constitution. So they pulled everybody together, and in 1851, they wrote a second constitution. And there's just this wonderful quote that some guy, one of the delegates to the convention, said, "The state is now strewed with the rotten, putrid carcasses of defunct corporations, and the effluvia is a stench in the nostrils of an outraged, swindled community. The people of the county I represent have been scourged too much by corporations to be willing to trust the legislature." So they gave the legislature very strict instructions. The state and local governments were absolutely prohibited from colluding in any way, giving any kind of legislation to corporations. And I think what's interesting is that some learning was obviously done, because not only did the people wish this to be the law, but for quite a few years, the Ohio courts also wanted it to be the law. And the Ohio courts supported this rigorous definition and controlling of corporations. What did they do? They said, shareholders must always be free to inspect the books of a corporation. They said corporations are not persons under the law in Ohio. The court said that in the state of Ohio, we do not agree with the Dartmouth decision. Do any of you know what the Dartmouth decision was about? It's rather complicated, but I'll try to make it very simple. The Supreme Court in 1819, you can just tell how soon the corporations tried to get a jump ahead of the people here. The Dartmouth case refers to Dartmouth College. And to make a long story short, Dartmouth College was a chartered college. It was given a charter by the state of New Hampshire. Supreme Court fell under the pressure of Daniel Webster. Actually, he was the lawyer for Dartmouth College, which argued the case that when the state gives a charter to a corporation, it's not really a charter, it's just like a contract. And the Supreme Court decided, it agreed. Yes, a charter is really a contract. And what does the Constitution say about contracts? It says that the government will and cannot interfere with the obligation of contracts. Now, what this is saying is, in a nutshell, that now the state brings into existence a corporation by giving it a charter, right? The state is the creator of the corporation through giving it this charter. Now the court said, it's not a charter. Once it's created, what that piece of paper really is a contract, and the state cannot interfere with it. In other words, the creator cannot interfere in any way now with the created. And the created is free to become what it will and ultimately destroy the creator if it will. The state of Ohio said, in Ohio, we don't agree with that. That's what the court said. Didn't stick, however. They said that corporations could not buy their own stock. They said that foreign corporations, and by the way, a foreign corporation in a state is just a corporation that's chartered in some other state but is doing business in your state. It's called a foreign corporation. They said any foreign corporation doing business in our state is tried, if it is sued, in our state courts. doesn't get to go to a federal court where it's going to get special treatment. It deals here with the problem that it's created here. It all makes great sense to me. And they issued a lot of quo warranto decisions. They closed quite a few corporations because of violations of their charters and so forth. Now, what happened to all this kind of what seems to be good trend is the corporations then took these decisions, either, well, took them to the Supreme Court. They said, we don't like this decision that the Ohio court has made on has made for us. We're going to take it off to the Supreme Court, and again and again and again, the Supreme Court overturned the state of Ohio's efforts to keep corporations in hand. Well, what did the people start to do in Ohio? And this video doesn't spend much time on this. And from the standpoint of what we do now, it ends up by saying, what do we do? It's too bad they didn't spend more time on what, how the people then began to organize in the latter half of the 19th century in Ohio. The workers of Ohio, the farmers of Ohio, and the immigrants of Ohio all organized in their respective ways to take a stand against this oppressive power of wealth and the corporation. They all realized something that I think is a really simple sentence, but it's so powerful. They realized that privileges granted to corporations are privileges denied to human beings. It's as simple as that. And when you come to grips with something as rock bottom as that, you are more stirred to do something about it. And I think that's one of the important things that we have to get out to the people we talk with and teach and live with in our communities. That when corporations have privileges granted to them, we lose ours in the process. We are denied those privileges when they are given them. I mean, look at our political system. It's just so clear, isn't it? But anyway, what happened in Ohio is the farmers organized granges, of course. I was amazed to learn that the first grange in Ohio was organized in 1868. And by 1875, there were 1,100 granges because the farmers were being so oppressed by the banks, given no credit, given no way to buy seed, equipment, whatever they needed. They were given no credit by the banks. They started to organize their own way of managing money and granting loans to one another. And it just took off like wildfire, obviously, which I hadn't realized before reading this book quite carefully. The National Farmers Alliance started in 1887, and it's one of the first times in this country, and this is one of the first organizations in the country that really started to build a movement culture. And again, this says a lot to us. If we want to make the kinds of changes we're talking about making here, it's not sort of carrying a sign and walking down the street. It's creating a powerful movement that will not be denied. And it really is. It's a cultural project of enormous magnitude and skill and thoughtfulness and vision. And the Farmers Alliance was one of the first to really begin thinking that way. They were not just protesting. They were critical of corporations and the whole economic system. They were not just protesting what was. They were critical of the larger whole and tried to help people make the connections within that whole. I found out that the AF of L was founded in Columbus, Ohio in 1886. The Knights of Labor were quite active in Ohio during the mid-1880s. The United Mine Workers Association was founded in Columbus, Ohio in 1890. And perhaps most important of all in terms of the power that they eventually built for themselves was the People's Party, which became known as the Populists. That People's Party was founded in Ohio in Cincinnati in 1891. What the People's Party obviously was about was an effort to not just make the parties that were already in existence, the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, better. They said there's no point in trying to make them better. We've got to reshape policy. We have to rewrite policy and go out there and create a political party of our own and make it happen, put it into place. Change the authority, in other words, as it existed in the country. Around 1890, very early 1890s, the populace actually elected quite a few governors, quite a few people to the Congress, and became a fairly effective, prominent power on the scene, and therefore, of course, frightened the dominant powers that were already on the scene. So what happened by 1896 was that the populace were pretty much co-opted, if you will, by the Democrats, who ran William Jennings Bryan for the presidency in 1896. He lost to McKinley, but in the process of that joining, that merging, the populace essentially declined from the scene, and the progressives stepped in to the vacuum. And over the course of the 20th century, of course, we had very much the progressives with us. Now, the progressives said, no, look, we don't have to overthrow everything. We don't have to have a new party. We just have to get a handle on these corporations and on the power, the inordinate power of wealth in the country. So what we'll do is we need to establish lots of regulatory agencies and keep these corporate operations in line, rein them in. So this was the era of the regulatory agency. As you probably know, the first regulatory agencies were begun by corporations, designed to, and I quote, make it look like a great deal was being done when in fact very little is intended to be done. And as the video pointed out, they have served ever since, and we've had more and more and more of them in the regulatory, in the environmental field, labor field, consumer field. They have served over the years very effectively to protect corporations from the people rather than protecting people from the corporations, as the film pointed out. The progressives, in other words, didn't really want fundamental control over corporations. They basically wanted to reduce harms done by corporations, and they wanted to do it without too much control. And therefore, what they basically did was they gave up. The progressives gave up. And some of it was ignorance and being caught up, as all of us would have been at some level at that time in our history, with the industrial age and what might be possible for human beings. It was all very exciting and had all of our imaginations going. And, gee, we don't want to put too much of a damper on these incredible corporations that can maybe just produce who knows what for us. And so they said, let's not interfere too much. We'll just try to, you know, keep them in hand. Try to regulate them. But in fact, it's such a game that's played according to the rules and on the field as defined by corporations themselves. And we get to exhaust ourselves, make ourselves feel like we're doing a great deal of work, when in fact we are probably are doing a great deal of work, but getting a very, very short distance. So I might say that I just read something about Ohio very recently. They passed campaign finance reform law out there about a year ago, November election a year ago. And indeed, they put a little bit of restraint on how much could go through what channels to buy corporations into candidates' coffers. However, what they said was absolutely unlimited was the right of corporations to spend whatever they would on election advertising. I mean, it's just such a joke. You can see that, yes, there's always, we just have such reason to be so suspicious of anything that comes out in the form of reform. Because while it may be a little better over there, it's probably going to end up being much worse in terms of the whole law that's passed, much worse for we the people over here in this area of what of the legislation that's just been passed. And sure enough, I think we're going to be joined by a band here any moment. You're setting it up downstairs and leaving us here by ourselves?
Well, you know.
Well, that's very kind of you. No, really, we appreciate it. And we hope that you'll join the revolution.
Okay.
And the revolution always needs music.
Absolutely. Music is very important in the revolution.
Better yet, start.
There you go. So I do want to just check in with you a little bit on something called rights-based organizing, which is a new way for we the people to begin to approach this challenge we're up against of corporate power. That's taking off, and that's, I think, makes a great deal of sense in terms of movement toward real democracy. But let's just take a breather. And any comments, questions, thoughts about the video or anything else? Lynn?
Well, I have a question. It seems to me that the whole history of so-called representative democracy has been a history of corruption. So my question is the term representative democracy an oxymoron?
Did you hear the question back there? Since there's such a grim track record in terms of representative democracy really bringing anything like real democracy, is that an oxymoron? Any thoughts? Any thoughts? It's a, certainly this little summary of Ohio's history would affirm Lynn's point very strongly. The people created a legislature, they elected people to it, and the legislature kind of gave the power away. Can we do better than that? And how can we do better than that?
Is it a monetary problem where they've gravitated to corporatism rather than even simply capitalism? Capitalism is about corruption eventually, you know, who has power and who does not. It's not as simple as capitalism. Capitalism seems like a fine system. Corporatism, the more money you get, the more power you're going to have. You're going to eventually control everything. Is that the flaw? I look at it that way. That's when the government and the corporations work together, that's fascism, isn't it?
That's fascism?
I think so.
Yes, I would quite agree with that. And I think you're right. Capitalism, well, we can define capitalism as we will. We could, in theory, I think, put limits on the size of how we want a business to function, on the scale of it, on the amount of stock that could be owned by any one corporation, on the area that any one corporation can do its business in, whatever. It would be some combination of capitalism as we know it now and some other form of governing, decision-making. But corporatism may indeed be unlimiting. In other words, corporations as we now have them simply have to get bigger, have to compete successfully, have to produce more and more of absolutely everything at the cost of absolutely anything. It's just the way it chews up the world around it. So, but that's not quite on the point that Lynn raised.
If there was some way to get the money out of the representation, if there was some way to have all your representatives really be concerned for the public good instead of
corporate,
the special interests, the money interests, well, then maybe it could work. But the way it is now, you can't have a democracy the way it is now. That's clear. because of the big money and then.
Well, I think
you're implying if we could redefine, let's say, the electoral representative system, start over. What are elections going to be like in this real democracy of ours? How are they going to work? Who's going to be able to serve? What is it all going to look like? What is the role of money in it? If you start all over, that's the only way you could possibly end up in a better place.
Well, I think a good approach, and Ron Paul, I don't know if anybody knows who Ron Paul is. He's a Republican congressman from Texas, and he put a bill in Congress last year to repeal the Federal Reserve Act. And I think that, I don't know how much people know about the Federal Reserve system, but it is a private bank that controls the money. And the government, basically it's usury is what it is. And so local economies are definitely looked down upon by corporations. And local economy would be an avenue to get back the control. And that if we can become self-sufficient, self-sustaining locally, and have influence in our local governments, which to me it looks like people have thrown away their power locally, and that the good old boys are right here in every little podunk town throughout the country, not to mention the big cities, but... You know, to me, it looks like if we can get a local economy going and get local control of our local governments, that's where it's got to start. You can't start at the top. You got to start at the bottom.
I think that's decentralization. We have corporations organize everything into a distribution network, and it's a centralized distribution. That's what makes them work. When you decentralize, you go to a local. I'll refer to an economic situation locally. When you decentralize, you go to the local production, distribution, and manufacture of goods for the benefit of the local community. When you decentralize, you cut the power of corporations, because corporations, like the Federal Reserve, distributing money, an energy company, distributing energy, are always extremely large, centralized distribution networks. Our power is to decentralize. And if you make any efforts to decentralize, I think you'll find that you get a whole lot of political feedback from fictitious entities against your interest.
We need more Paul Glovers.
I think indeed. That's and I think decentralization is a very key concept.
But it's simple, but nobody ever talks about it.
Need more Paul Glovers.
Who ever reads Leopold Kohr anymore? You know Leopold Kohr?
I think I like Leopold.
Well, he wrote a book called The Breakdown of Nations and several other things that relate to decentralizing nations and power and governing.
I mean, when you look at boycotts, look at how much power a boycott has. I mean, there was a boycott of Shell Oil Company because they were involved in apartheid. Well, yeah. And Nestle, although Nestle somehow was able to skate out. I mean, they were able to go somewhere else. Nestle came out okay, but these corporations they're scared to death of consumers getting together. We could pull the plug on Walmart, really.
Consumer power is a legitimate power, and it has its place, the boycott, the not buying, the green buying, whatever you may wish to call it. It has its place. It's part of the picture. I do think it's so important for us to keep in mind that consumer power is not citizen power. It's a reactive power. And what we might want to talk just a little bit about is communities beginning to organize themselves around what you might call citizen power. There are an increasing number of communities around the country that aren't going to take it anymore from corporations that they see as defining their communities, their lives, their economies, their environments, and they've had it. And they are, in most cases, the communities that are moving forward in this way are also communities that are pretty much up against the wall. What difference does it make if we really press to define this community as we will and to define corporate activity in this community as we will through local law? Now, obviously, when they say, geez, we're going to pass laws and say what corporations can do here and what they can't do here, that's big stuff. You really want me to pass a law like that, the citizens will say? They will only say that if they are, if they're mad, and if they have a good reason to say that the corporations that are at work in this county of mine or this township of mine are destroying my livelihood, my family culture, this community's culture, and so forth. But the point is, more and more towns and communities are finding themselves in that situation. This kind of work started primarily down in South Central Pennsylvania, where an increasing number of corporations were moving in and buying up farms and creating hog factories, hog farm factories, destroying the environment, putting those farmers, buying up their land, employing them as hog farmers for the hog farming corporation, polluting the land with manure lagoons of enormous areas and stench and concentration loads, and so forth and so on. So working with a young lawyer down there, a number of those townships, 10, 12 of them at this stage, have passed ordinances saying that in this township, corporate farming will not be permitted. Only if it's a cooperative corporation or a family corporation, yes, there are some exceptions, but no corporation can come in from afar, buy land here, and start a corporate farming operation. Other communities have passed laws, and this is primarily true out in California, saying within our jurisdiction, there will be no corporations planting, selling, advertising genetically modified seed and organisms. Another community has said, within our jurisdictions, no more big box stores will be allowed. A number of other townships down in Pennsylvania have said, within our jurisdiction, no corporation will dump any sludge on our farmlands. And a couple of these townships, get this one, we didn't prepare you that well for this point this evening, but as you probably know, corporations are persons under the law. Corporations have more rights under the Constitution than you have. They have the privacy rights, all the property rights of the Constitution, due process, equal protection, eminent domain, and so forth and so on.
Is there a way to reverse that?
What these towns are saying is that within our jurisdiction, corporations will have no constitutional rights. So, of course, they're contesting these laws. They will find ways to contest them. I think it's a number of things are fair to say. First of all, it's fair to say that if we don't have hundreds, thousands of communities passing ordinances of this sort, if we don't have a real movement of this kind of expression of control over corporations, claiming our right to define corporations and be sovereign in our own jurisdictions, if we don't have thousands of communities moving forward legally in this way, this movement will probably be squashed.
The issue of law enforcement. It seems to me, once again, my other observation is their job is to protect the interests of the rich and beat in the heads of poor people who get out of line. And anything they might occasionally do for some ordinary person is merely a byproduct of the real program. okay, which is as part of this corporate system. So I just wondered if you had anything to say about how that would play into the democracy equation.
Well, others might have a comment too. We've talked tonight very much about corporations. I think it's important to back up a little bit and point out that what corporations are all about is property. A corporation is nothing more than a great big glob of property, if you will, wealth and property. And indeed, this whole nation was founded on the protection of property. This is where stability would lie. And stability was so important, stability at all costs. And how do we keep stability? We protect property. That's the primary thing. Protecting people is less critical than protecting property. And of course, the Constitution itself is designed with property at its center, not people at its center. And the governing class is a propertied class, has been, will, always has been. So indeed, the armed forces of the country, the police forces, are brought out to protect property, first and foremost. Most people say, oh, yes, of course. I mean, there's a lot of agreement that that's kind of what they ought to be doing, because we've all bought into the stability thing. Behave well. Don't rock the ship. If you want to see change, work through the channels. So destroying property, being obstreperous, is not a good thing. Certainly out in Seattle in 1999, all the fuss that was made when a store window was broken. There was almost no damage done out there, almost none. But that's what we heard about, and that's what people, so many of them, were prepared to hang on to and accuse the protesters of behaving badly. Because property is foremost. And until that, I think that very much has to be addressed in the course of what a real democracy looks like and what communities have to incorporate in that conversation they hold. What do we really value here? Is it the inclusion of people, their participation, their just inclusion? A fair economic picture for everyone? Is that what we care about? Or do we care about protecting what everybody has?
I think when you look at the way money affects politics, money buys politicians and buys control. When you look at the local police departments, they used to be a arm of local government. You've got to look at the source of the funds. Police departments all over the country have been expanding at alarming rates with extremely good equipment. And most of that is from federally financed programs. So they come in and all of a sudden, since they're getting a lot of money from, say, the FBI or these people, all of a sudden they're almost subservient to that agency when before they were a local arm of government. Now they're almost subservient at the federal level because of their funding sources. And I think that's a planned program. I don't think that's accidental. I think
so they're sort of like pawns underneath the.
Yes, they've been placed in a hierarchy. Locally, before, local police had a lot of power. When you get to the nuclear waste dump in this county, the state police sort of backed away from enforcing the corporate position. They were on the side of the county, and by not actively enforcing that allowed a lot of success. Everybody was against that account, but I'm not sure that would happen now. I think the police would feel their allegiances to their funding source, and that's who they'd support.
There is a city and a county in California that can, I think, give us a very good model for how they built an interest and commitment in their citizens to eventually what is going on the ballot in November in this community is an ordinance that says no corporations outside of their jurisdiction can donate in any way or involve themselves in any way in the elections of that jurisdiction.
Is that Arcata?
It's Humboldt. It's actually Humboldt County. Here is how they got to that point. As you might imagine, you can't sort of waltz in and say, hey, let's put this on the fall ballot and get much enthusiasm for it. In 1998, a little organization out there called Democracy Unlimited of Humboldt County asked the town board, I guess it was the City Council of Arcata, asked them to put a resolution on the fall ballot that said, we as a community want to examine the question, how can we have democracy when corporations hold so much wealth and power? And the resolution includes also that the City Council will sponsor two town halls on that question. That's all it was. So, of course, this was called Measure F. So they had a big conversation. Gee, shall we put this on the ballot? And the community talked about it, and the town council voted, and they said, yes, let's do it. So they put it on the ballot. The community voted, said, yes, we want to have these conversations. And the town had, the City Council had to sponsor these conversations. And they were well facilitated and conducted. And there were 500 people at the first one and 300 some at the second one. They also said that from that conversation, they would form a committee of the town, it's a City Council, SUNY City, called the Corporations and Democracy Committee. Right, to advise in an ongoing way the City Council on issues of democracy and corporations in their city. So they formed this committee. This was 1999 now. In 2000, they had some community workshops. They held a number of open community workshops that people could come to on the question of first steps in dismantling corporate rule. So quite a few folks in the town came to these workshops, and they wrestled with this question. What would be the first steps? How would you go about it? What would you have to know? Blah, blah, blah. So more and more people started thinking about this stuff. Then in 2002, they decided as a city council to put a cap on formula restaurants, which is what I was just talking about. They passed an ordinance that said, this community will not allow any more formula or chain restaurants to come in. I don't know where that went, by the way. I don't know what the story is on that. In 2004, there was an Arcata resolution on corporate rights, and the Committee on Democracy and Corporations said that there should be community-wide discussions on this point, that only persons who are human beings should be able to participate in democratic process. So now they had another conversation. Only persons who are human beings, not these artificial entities called corporations, should be allowed to participate in the democratic process. All right, now we're coming up close to the end here. In 2003, 2004, something opened itself to them, and they made the most of it. What opened up? There is out there a big lumber operation called Maxam Corporation. There was an district attorney elected out there that sued Maxam Corporation for fraud. So what Maxam Corporation did immediately was they asked for a recall of this district attorney. It's just amazing what audacity they have. They wanted to have a recall for this district attorney. It was inconveniencing their activity in the county. So what happened then was they took a poll, and they got the students from Humboldt College to move throughout the whole county and take a poll of people about, get the community pulse, is how they put it, about their feelings on corporations, on Maxim, on this recall. And, of course, what they did was they built a lot of information and enthusiasm for, first of all, defeating the recall, which they did. No problem defeating the recall. And by this time, as you might imagine, they've now got a whole population of people who have figured out that democracy and corporations, as we know them, are not a fit. And so now what they've done is they have put on the ballot, with careful drafting and public discussion, they have put on the ballot a Fair Elections and Local Democracy initiative for this fall, which says that corporations will not be allowed to involve themselves in any political way in the local... So this is a law now. This is a law. So these people are now putting themselves on the legal line by passing an ordinance, if they pass it, that says corporations will not be allowed to involve themselves in any way, corporations that are not part of the local area. If they're located in the town, they apparently have not included them. But outside corporations will not be involved in any way in local elections, not contributing, not advertising, not speaking, so forth. So in other words, what they've done is they have, over time, brought this community of people to a level of awareness and political commitment and sense of empowerment to act at this level. But it's a process, and it begins with some simple questions and people talking to one another and building trust in one another through those conversations. We just need to build so much trust, because we don't have much of that between and among ourselves anymore. It's been broken down, and it plays right into those who would govern us when we have lost that trust. And the only way I think we can get it back is by engaging one another in questions like Humboldt County did, workshops, conversations, with a purpose toward an end, so that we have some forward motion and enthusiasm that can build and keep people engaged.
That was Virginia Rasmussen of POCLAD leading a discussion on corporations and democracy earlier this fall in Alfred, New York. At the beginning of Rasmussen's talk, she referred to a young man in the documentary Corpore Nation citing mutual aid as a key element of democracy. Mutual aid is a specific term in the context of political economy. This is the definition as written by Wikipedia. In political economy, mutual aid is a term which describes a principle central to libertarian socialism or anarchism and is used to signify the economic concept of voluntary reciprocal exchange of resources and services for mutual benefit. As a concept, it was developed and advanced by the anarcho-communist Peter Kropotkin. In his book, Mutual Aid, A Factor in Evolution, Kropotkin explored the utility of cooperation as a survival mechanism for animals in order to counteract the conception of evolution as a fierce competition for survival between individuals that provided a rationalization for the theories of social Darwinism. His observations of indigenous peoples in Siberia guided him to conclude that not all human societies were so competitive as Europe's. In another of his books, The Conquest of Bread, Kropotkin proposed a system of economics based on mutual exchanges made in a system of voluntary cooperation. Kropotkin's thesis was based on the premise that scarcity was unnecessary and that it was possible to produce enough wealth to satisfy the needs of everybody by working only 5 hours a day during adult life, leaving the rest of the day to satisfy other desires. But that flawed economic systems had led to inefficient allocation of resources, which prevented this bounty from being achieved.
The tyranny of the clock. In no characteristic is existing society in the West so sharply distinguished from the earlier societies, whether of Europe or the East, than it is in conception of time. To the ancient Chinese or Greek, to the Arab herdsman or Mexican peon of today, time is represented in the cyclic process of nature, the alteration of day and night, the passage from season to season. The nomads and farmers measured and still measure their day from sunrise to sunset, and their year in terms of seed time and harvest, of the falling leaf and the ice thawing on the lakes and rivers. The farmer worked according to the elements, the craftsman for so long as he felt it necessary to perfect his product. Time was seen in a process of natural change, and men were not concerned in its exact measurement. For this reason, civilizations highly developed in other respects had the most primitive means of measuring time, the hourglass with its trickling sand or dripping water, the sundial, useless on a dull day, and the candle or lamp, whose unburnt remnant of oil or wax indicated the hours. All these devices were approximate and inexact, and were often rendered unreliable by the weather or the personal laziness of the tender. Nowhere in the ancient or medieval world were more than a tiny minority of men concerned with time in the terms of mathematical exactitude. Modern, Western man, however, lives in a world which runs according to the mechanical and mathematical symbols of clock time. The clock dictates his movements and inhibits his actions. The clock turns time from a process of nature into a commodity that can be measured and bought and sold like soap or succulents. And because, without some means of exact timekeeping, industrial capitalism could never have developed and could not continue to exploit the workers, the clock represents an element of mechanical tyranny in the lives of modern men more potent than any individual exploiter or than any other machine. It is valuable to trace the historical process by which the clock influenced the social development of modern European civilization. It is a frequent circumstance of history that a culture of civilization develops the device that will later be used for its destruction. The ancient Chinese, for example, invented gunpowder, which was developed by the military experts of the West and eventually led to the Chinese civilization itself being destroyed by the high explosives of modern warfare. Similarly, the supreme achievement of the ingenuity of the craftsmen in the medieval cities of Europe was the invention of the mechanical clock, which, with its revolutionary alteration of the concept of time, materially assisted the growth of exploiting capitalism and the destruction of the medieval culture. There was a tradition that the clock appeared in the 11th century as a device for ringing bells at regular intervals in the monasteries, which, with the regimented life they imposed on their inmates, were the closest social approximation in the Middle Ages to the factory of today. The first authenticated clock, however, appeared in the 13th century, and it was not until the 14th century that clocks became common as ornaments of the public buildings in the German cities. These early clocks, operated by weights, were not particularly accurate, and it was not until the 16th century that any great reliability was attained. In England, for instance, the clock at Hampton Court, made in 1540, is said to have been the first accurate clock in the country. And even the accuracy of the 16th century clocks are relative, for they were equipped only with hour hands. The idea of measuring time in minutes and seconds had been thought out by the early mathematicians as far back as the 14th century, but it was not until the invention of the pendulum in 1657 that sufficient accuracy was attained to permit the addition of a minute hand, and the second hand did not appear until the 18th century. These two centuries, it should be observed, were those in which capitalism grew to such an extent that it was able to take advantage of the Industrial Revolution in technique in order to establish its domination over society. The clock, as Lewis Mumford has pointed out, represents the key machine of the machine age, both for its influence on technics and for its influence on the habits of men. Technically, the clock was the first really automatic machine that attained any importance in the life of men. Previous to its invention, the common machines were of such a nature that their operation depended on some external and unreliable force, such as human or animal muscles, water, or wind. It is true that the Greeks had invented a number of primitive automatic machines, but these were used, like Hero's steam engine, either for obtaining supernatural effects in the temples or for amusing the tyrants of Levantine cities. But the clock was the first automatic machine that attained a public importance and a social function. Clockmaking became the industry from which men learnt the elements of machine making and gained the technical skill that was to produce the complicated machinery of the Industrial Revolution. Socially, the clock had a more radical influence than any other machine, and that it was the means by which the regularization and regimentation of life necessary for an exploiting system of industry could best be obtained. The clock provided a means by which time, a category so elusive that no philosophy has yet determined its nature, could be measured concretely in the more tangible terms of space provided by the circumference of a clock dial. Time as duration became disregarded, and men began to talk and think always of lengths of time, just as if they were talking of lengths of calico. And time, being now measured in mathematical symbols, became regarded as a commodity that could be bought and sold in the same way as any other commodity. The new capitalists, in particular, became rabidly time-conscious. Time, here symbolizing the labor of the workers, was regarded by them almost as if it were the chief raw material of industry. Time is money became one of the key slogans of capitalist ideology, and the timekeeper was the most significant of the new types of official introduced by the capitalist dispensation. In the early factories, the employers went so far as to manipulate their clocks or sound their factory whistles at the wrong times in order to defraud the workers of a little of this valuable new commodity. Later, such practices became less frequent, but the influence of the clock imposed a regularity on the lives of the majority of men which had previously been known only in the monastery. Man actually became like clocks, acting with a repetitive regularity which has no resemblance to the rhythmic life of a natural being. They became, as the Victorian phrase put it, as regular as clockwork. Only in the country districts, where the natural lives of animals and plants and the elements still dominated life, did any large proportion of the population fail to succumb to the deadly tick of monotony. At first, this new attitude to time, this new regularity of life, was imposed by the clock-owning masters on the unwilling poor. The factory slave reacted in his spare time by living a chaotic irregularity which characterized the gin-sodden slums of early 19th century industrialism. Men fled to the timeless world of drink or Methodist inspiration, but gradually the idea of regularity spread downward among the workers. 19th century religion and morality played their part by proclaiming a sin of, quote, wasting time. The introduction of mass-produced watches and clocks in the 1850s spread time-conscious among those who had previously merely reacted to the stimulus of the knocker-up or the factory whistle. In the church and the school and the office and the workshop, punctuality was held up as the greatest of the virtues. Out of this slavish dependence on mechanical time, which spread insidiously into every class in the 19th century, there grew up the demoralizing regimentation of life which characterizes factory work today. The man who fails to conform faces social disapproval and economic ruin. If he is late at the factory, the worker will lose his job or even, at the present day, find himself in prison. Hurried meals, the regular morning and evening scramble for trains or buses, the strain of having to work to time schedules all contribute by digestive and nervous disturbance to ruin health and shorten life. Nor does the financial imposition of regularity tend, in the long run, to greater efficiency. Indeed, the quality of the product is usually much poorer because the employer, regarding time as a commodity which he has to pay for, forces the operative to maintain such a speed that his work must necessarily be skimped. Quantity rather than quality became the criterion. The enjoyment is taken out of the work itself, and the worker, in his turn, becomes a clock watcher, concerned only with when he will be able to escape to the scanty and monotonous leisure of industrial society, in which he, quote, kills time by cramming in as much time-scheduled and mechanicized enjoyment of cinema, radio, and newspaper as his wage packet and his tiredness will allow. Only if he is willing to accept the hazards of living by his faith or his wits can the man without money avoid living as a slave to the clock. The problem of the clock is, in general, similar to that of the machine. Mechanical time is valuable as a means of coordination of activities in a highly developed society, just as the machine is valuable as a means of reducing unnecessary labor to a minimum. Both are valuable for the contribution they make to the smooth running of society and should be used insofar as they assist men to cooperate efficiently and to eliminate monotonous toil and social confusion. But neither should be allowed to dominate men's lives as they do today. Now the movement of the clock sets the tempo of men's lives. They become the servant of the concept of time, which they themselves have made, and are held in fear, like in Frankenstein, by his own monster. In a sane and free society, such an arbitrary domination of man's functions by either clock or machine would obviously be out of the question. The domination of man by the creation of man is even more ridiculous than the domination of man by man. Mechanical time would be relegated to its true function of a means of reference and coordination, and men would return again to a balanced view of life no longer dominated by time regulation and the worship of the clock. Complete liberty implies freedom from the tyranny of abstractions, as well as from the rule of men.
The Tyranny of the Clock, an essay by George Woodcock, first published in 1944 and produced for radio by Audio Anarchy, audioanarchy.org. The music featured in the program was Leave No Millionaire Behind by Pierce Woodward, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us on the web and download MP3s of this and previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks for listening. My